Welcome to Building the Future, hosted by Kevin Horick. With millions of listeners a month, Building the Future has quickly become one of the fastest rising programs, with a focus on interviewing startups, entrepreneurs, investors, CEOs, and more. The radio and TV show airs in 15 markets across the globe, including Silicon Valley. For full showtimes, past episodes, or to sponsor the show, please visit buildingthefutureshow.com.
Do you have an app idea that you've been dreaming about but don't know how to actually start building it? Use Bubble. I've been using Bubble for a number of years now. It's an extremely powerful no-code platform that enables you to build, launch, and scale real products without investing thousands of dollars on engineers, designers, or spending time trying to code it yourself. Use Bubble's visual drag-and-drop tool to create really anything from marketplaces, SaaS products, and so much more. Join over 2 million people, including myself, already using Bubble to launch and grow businesses. Welcome back to the show. Today we have Robert Reinhardt. He's a video solutions architect and he's a contributing editor to Streaming Media Magazine. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you on the show. You've done a tremendous amount of stuff. And after we chatted, I don't know, a few weeks ago before we were recording, I realized that I've actually read a bunch of your Flash books from back in the day. I like went back in my old box from college and like I found a bunch of them and I was like, I knew I had these, but I didn't want to mention it until I validated that I had them.
Right. But, well, thank you. Thank you for buying them. You probably helped me through a little bit of strife in the early days there.
Sure. So before we get into kind of what you're doing today, maybe let's start off with your background and kind of where you grew up.
Sure. I'm originally from St. Louis, Missouri in the States. Grew up in the suburbs there. Did you want me to go in education too?
Sure.
Right now? Too?
Sure.
Yeah. And so I was a little all over the place when I first started out. I was originally pre-med, went to school at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, and ended up, long story shorter, I studied film and photography at Ryerson University in Toronto. And that experience really changed the course of my life, going into more media and media production.
Interesting. Okay. So how did you make that transition? Because it's quite different than, you know, going into medicine.
Yeah. You know, I think I was raised in a conservative Catholic family and always sort of felt I had to follow a certain path, right? I mean, it's I went to Catholic schools my whole life, and I went to an all boys private school in high school, and they all groom you to be, you know, lawyers, doctors, all those kind of, you know, stable professions that make you money. And and so, you know, I sort of went along with that script, and you know, not to get too deep into it, but my dad was diagnosed with cancer when I was 18, probably 17. And he passed away when I was 19. So I was a year in the university. And when he passed away, it really sort of gave me a little bit of insight into just why I was interested in doing the things that I did. And I'd always had an interest in photography and media. I was an editor of my high school newspaper. I did a lot of darkroom work with black and white photography. I did whatever video I could do back then. It was, you know, in the 80s, there wasn't a whole lot that you could do without expensive gear, right? You had to have, you know, you were lucky if you had SVHS and, you know, any kind of like, you know, there wasn't even anything like a nonlinear editor out there. Right. And so, I feel really fortunate again that I've grown up sort of in an analog age that turned into a very, very digital age, and none of the analog none of the analog technology that I grew up with is really in play anymore. I mean, who uses film anymore? I mean, turning lemons into lemonade. When my dad passed away from cancer, I really sort of made a bet with myself. I was doing more and more photography. It was probably art therapy for me at the time. And, Ryerson had an accelerated program at the time, and where you could finish the whole first year of a 4-year film and photography degree in one summer on a beautiful island, Prince Edward Island, on the east coast of Canada. And so I figured, hey, if my portfolio can get me into this sort of restricted, exclusive first year program, then maybe I have some talent there. That was my bet. If I got accepted to that accelerated program, I'd go with it. If I didn't, then I'd stick with the pre-med and see where that took me. And sure enough, I made it into that program, and you know, the rest is history, as they say. So I went into that program, and because I'd had enough credits in pre-med and math and any of the other, English, I was able to take those elective credits in the full year program and explore so many different media classes that my still photography classmates didn't get to enjoy. So I picked still photography as my option, but I took all these media and film classes with my extra time in my schedule, because I wasn't doing English 101 and other, you know, prerequisites. And so I just feel really fortunate I had opportunities like that to explore.
Interesting. So walk us through your career, maybe some highlights along the way, because you've done a ton of stuff.
Yeah, my dad was an entrepreneur. He started a family company that my oldest brothers now run with their kids. And so I've always had, again, just super fortunate to have this sort of idea that, oh yeah, if you put your mind to something, you can do something. And I know that that's a very privileged position. Not everyone gets to have role models like that growing up. My dad didn't really teach me a whole lot about running a business. I learned a lot of hard lessons and, you know, and how to spend money and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, he passed away before I could sort of get some of that knowledge. But you know, where it took me, because I'd had the media and film production experience, and I'd always done well in math and science. And so doing more and more stuff digitally came second nature to me. Heck, I mean, I remember teaching my instructors at Ryerson how to do certain things in Photoshop. I mean, we're talking, you know, very early versions of Photoshop, very early versions of Adobe Premiere. And I'll never forget, I bought one of the very first or one of the very last available Mac clones. I think it was a UMAX, and they were the last licensee to be selling Mac clones. And so I'll never forget outfitting that with a mini DV or DV video capture cards, because mini DV had just sort of come out in the late 90s, and it was an affordable way for people to get into video production. And so, I mean, they were still expensive cameras relative to other things. You know, you were spending a minimum of $1,000, which, you know, with inflation, I don't know what that would be these days, but it wasn't cheap. You know, you were outfitting these computers with gear that wasn't nearly as cheap as it is now from Blackmagic Design or any other vendors that are out there. And again, just really fortunate to be able to have the ability to have a computer of my own and a capture card and be working with mini DV, which was tape, but it was digital on tape, right? And so,
yeah, remember those days.
and there were still problems with it. You still had to run it linearly, right? You still had to play your tape to capture it. And it was all over FireWire, which was, you know, an emerging standard at the time. Heck, I just saw a FireWire adapter in my case, and I'm like, gosh, I'll probably never use this again, but I still have it. Haven't thrown it out. And so, you know, playing with media production, being able to play with tools like Adobe Premiere and Photoshop early on. I mean, Adobe had their act together pretty well. And before they acquired Macromedia, Macromedia was moving along with their product line too in the 90s when Flash came out and Dreamweaver. And, you know, that just made them they really had the web market covered when Adobe didn't. And anyway, I don't need to go down that path so much, but the ability to, you know, do so much exploration on my own and continue my studies at Ryerson was just really great. I felt really privileged to have instructors that really just knew their craft there of, you know, whether they were more artist, creative based teachers or people who were working in the industry doing, you know, high end catalog photography for big brands. They felt really lucky to have the kind of, most of the instructors at Ryerson I had were working professionals and, you know, taught as part of, you know, what they wanted to give back to the community that they were part of. And again, just really fortunate to be part of that. I started working in film as soon as I graduated from Ryerson. I actually, one of my biggest breaks, and I always tell this to students of mine or anytime I'm doing a presentation that is really more about self-improvement or career oriented, I start with a slide that says my best opportunity paid me $90 a week. And that was teaching at the Maine workshops in Rockport, Maine. I'd heard about them while I was in school. I made a drive all the way from Toronto on my own overnight to Rockport, Maine to go to their job fair. And I was hired pretty quickly to be teaching assistant in their digital lab. And so I spent my first summer right out of school being a teaching assistant for all of the workshops that in the digital lab that went through there. And as I was prepping those workshops, or rather the gear in for those workshops, the lab manager conveniently quit. Like he was already at odds with the director of the program. The director then rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. He was a brilliant guy, but at the same time, you just sort of had to navigate him. And that guy that lab manager was fed up. So I worked there for maybe 2 weeks before that guy quit. And so all of a sudden, I'll never forget the director saying, "So will you take over management?" And I'm like, "Whoa, okay." So I'm going from TA to manager, and they let me bring in another TA, and so I could focus on that. So I was running an entire lab with, you know, probably 20 workstations, making sure that the software was up to date. And I met every instructor that went through there, which was, again, that's why it was the best opportunity. I made $90 a week. He didn't increase my pay, that director, and nor did I ask for it. They did actually, they felt a little badly for me, so they let me use my car as a shuttle to get people from the Portland, Maine airport on the weekends to the workshops, because there was no easy way. It was like a 2-hour drive, I think, from Portland to Rockport, Maine. And so I actually made as much money in one day, if not more, for what they paid me to use my car to pick up people at the airport as I did all week, you know, work. And there were lots of great benefits to it. I mean, I got to go to the teacher meetups, any of the instructors that were, all the workshops were a week long for the most part. And every Thursday before there was a wrap, there was a wrap party at the end of every week where everyone showed off from every program their work. Again, it was sort of like Ryerson. I wasn't just hanging out with the digital people. I was seeing brilliant photographers that I had studied that were based in New York. I think Joyce Tennyson was one of my favorite photographers, and I was young enough then. I was right out of school. She even was like, "Oh, you should come model for me." And I didn't take advantage of some of those opportunities where I could have, like, you know, followed down different rabbit holes there. But I just met every instructor, and one of the instructors, to make this, you know, a little more brief, was co-writing a book with Linda Weinman, and okay, I think it was Deconstructing Web Graphics 2. And he put me in touch with Linda to be the tech editor of this book. And so I, you know, via email and everything that was available electronically back then, I established a relationship with Linda Weinman, who, you know, created the 216 web color palette and, you know, did all this groundbreaking work in the early days of the web when it came to design. And super smart person, obviously. She created a very big company, lynda.com, that LinkedIn ended up buying, and then Microsoft bought LinkedIn. So she grew a wonderful company that I worked on and on with ever since I worked on that her book, and I was invited to tech edit other books of hers. She wrote for New Writers, and New Writers was a very popular imprint back in the day for web design books. Like every Flash creative guy I knew, our person was writing books for New Writers as that wanted to have any cred in the creative side of things. So I always liked having one foot in the creative side and the other foot really heavy into the tech as well, because tech was where I always felt at home. And that's what led to me tech editing other books, and outside of Linda's books, New Writers wanted me to edit other books because they liked how quickly and well I would tech edit those books. And then I was started to get into teaching too when I was living in Toronto. I was hired after coming back from the Maine Photographic Workshops. Again, I had sort of another feather in my cap, and I was able to teach classes without a master's degree to, you know, in sort of those adjunct programs that either University of Toronto or Ryerson had. You know, some schools call it professional development programs or continuing education. So I was teaching in those programs within, you know, a year of graduating. And, and so I felt really, again, lucky to have the connections that I had. And then, so I started to teach web curriculum, teaching Photoshop, and that led to when Flash came out, I was like, gosh, there's not a whole lot of material on this book. I'd already established connections in the publishing world. And I put to, at the time, the same guy, John Warren Lentz, who introduced me to Linda, said, hey, why don't we write a Flash book together? And so we wrote the Flash 4 Bible. It was the very first book I wrote. I wrote the majority of all the, I wrote the majority of the tech content in that book, and he did the design content. And he had a really great idea. He said, hey, for the things that we don't know so well, why don't we invite guest contributors to write basically things that became sidebars in the book. And it was a brilliant idea. And I don't know if you remember names like Colin Mook or
Totally
Clement. These people, you know, were doing great things with Flash. And Colin actually lived in Toronto too, which was great. It was a small world in many facets. The Flash in the Can conference, which is still around, it's just called FITC, and it's not a Flash conference anymore, but it's a creative and design conference that I was part of when I lived in Toronto and when I moved away from Toronto. And those writing the Flash 4 Bible, of course, put me on the map for Flash. And I was doing, I never just wrote books. I was doing Flash development for companies in Toronto. And again, I had another foot in media production. And my very first film was a Warner Brothers film called Gossip. I hired a student to work on it with me. We had the program computers, so that when Norman Reedus, who was just starting his career out, he went on to do Walking Dead and all sorts of other content after that. But he and a bunch of young stars were in that movie, and I had to make it look like he knew what he was doing in Photoshop, right? So I remember the assistant I hired, he and I programmed Director at the time, because we could still do more in Director than we could at Flash when it came to sort of standalone applications. So Flash was definitely geared more to a web browser. And so we programmed computers to do all sorts of fun stuff. So, you know, he could literally just hit the letter P on the keyboard and it would select a face, zoom it in. And, you know, we just had all these sequences planned, and he could hit another button on the keyboard and it would send some output to the printer. Of course, the printer was already preloaded with printed stuff, so you weren't actually waiting for the printer. It would just would page feed it, and it looked like, wow, that was fast. And not only was I responsible for the tech in that room, but my senior project, my graduation project at Ryerson, were these very large Polaroid prints. I shot on 4x5 Polaroid Type 55 film, which is a black and white film, but I was using the color enlargers at Ryerson to print on very large paper. Like, we're talking, you know, like 3 feet by 4 foot pictures. And, you know, I had to always schedule special access and buy very expensive paper that I had to do lots of trial and error. So I had, I, and you know, I had this in a digital form too, and not many people back then had, you know, a CD-ROM that they could hand to people. So I'll never forget when I interviewed with the director of Gossip, Davis Guggenheim. I handed him my disc and said, yeah, here, I put this, this is my multimedia presentation of my work. And he loved it. He's like, you're basically this character and we're hiring you. And so, and they got me for peanuts, of course, because like I, you know, I was pretty young and just out of school, but that led to great relationships. Again, I know it's hard in this day and age for to tell anyone who's starting out their career to like not pay attention to the money. Look at the opportunity that's presented. And if it lines up with what you want to do, then take it. I mean, and I felt really lucky that, I mean, in the end, I definitely made a decent amount of money on that production and other work that I did. My future wife worked on that production with me too. And we both moved to LA together after that, because that director and the producer, Jeff Silver, encouraged us to move to LA. And they, you know, everyone always thinks Hollywood's this sharky place and where, you know, people step on each other and take credit for work. But those, they were two of the most generous people I've ever met. And they set us up with other work when we got there, mainly their own productions. And so I felt really lucky. We had a direct link to Warner Brothers. The last website my partner Snowdowd and I worked on was the Training Day website, and because we had these connections, we had like really exclusive access to the set. Like most people who did websites were just handed materials by Warner Brothers or whoever the media company was, and like, here's the material, make a website, you know. But yeah, we were living in LA, we got to go on set and, you know, take pictures on our own. We always had to have it approved by someone at Warner Brothers. But I'll never forget, there was I can't remember the rap artist who did the background. They invited all sorts of rap artists to be part of the Training Day soundtrack, and Snow put together a beautiful portfolio of imagery that the director of that film wanted to show to other rap artists to inspire them for the film. And so she had to put together all this material that basically made Ethan Hawke and Denzel Washington look like they were the characters they were in this film, even though it hadn't been shot yet. Right?
That's amazing.
So he did some really cool work together, put these art boards together. I can't remember if they were called inspiration books, but anyway, the rappers loved it. And I, for the website, which was of course a Flash site, I wanted to, I couldn't, because the soundtrack hadn't been finalized while we were working on the website, I remember having to recreate on my own. I had a little bit of a music background, nothing too fancy, but I know how to read sheet music. And I basically had a MIDI keyboard where I reproduced the background line to one of these, you know, very moody tracks that was going to be put in the movie, so that I didn't have to have the voice in it. I just wanted this sort of loop of the music to this rap track in as the background music on the Flash site. And that was so much fun. Like, I'm like, hey, I'm actually making music for this website, and they approved it. It all went, you know, very smoothly. And, you know, again, we called ourselves the Makers because of that company, and we still have that company, my partner and I. We called ourselves the Makers just because we made all sorts of different things. And that was sort of before maker became a big term. I mean, it was definitely a term. We derived it from the fact that any photographer in the late 90s that was creative, like, oh, I'm not a photographer, I'm an image maker. And so, oh, image maker, like image maker was this like sort of, you know, highfalutin term that was sounded better than photographer. And so, well, we don't just make images, we make all sorts of things. And we're just like, well, let's call the Makers. And that domain was available, themakers.com. So that you know, we sort of got known for making all sorts of content that wasn't necessarily available to regular web developers or designers at the time. We shot on Super 8, and I knew how to transfer that to video and capture it, of course. So we just got to play with a lot of, like, you know, again, we weren't just handed materials. We actually got to create content with a lot of our early projects. And of course, right after Training Day was actually put on hold as a release, I think because of 9/11. And so it was a little lackluster. We done all this work to, you know, put together this Training Day site. We were waiting for it to launch. It's like, uh-oh, we're going to delay this launch by a few months. Like, we can't do it right now. There's too much, you know, going on in the world. And that was just before another economic downturn. And so the it was our last Warner Brothers production. They started to cut back on budgets and did a lot more templated kind of websites for productions. You know, things just started. Again, I'm sort of jumping the gun. You know, Flash eventually wasn't being used for web design and web experiences. You know, down the road, once in 2011, I believe it was, when the iPhone effectively killed Flash, everything, you know, started to build up again in HTML5. And so, again, just really fortunate to have been involved with some of those early experiences. Before that, too, we did work for PBS. Davis Guggenheim, he had us do work for a documentary he did for PBS on teachers in L.A. And that was back in the day. I'll never forget. It was one of the first video-heavy websites I had to work on, where we had to have everything encoded in real Windows Media and QuickTime. So, you know, we had to, like, every clip that was on that site had to be in three formats. Just, and, you know, JavaScript wasn't that great. It wasn't great at picking up what plugins you had installed. So, you know, we've come a long way. Anyway.
Yeah. Interesting. As somebody that did Flash, you know, early in my career, I still think HTML5 and Canvas, and it's not the same. And just the creativity of things that you could do in Flash, I don't think is been lost because of, you know, like, just the fact that Apple basically killed off Flash. Do you agree with that, or what are your thoughts around that?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I don't do much on the design front or content generation these days, but, you know, Flash was one of the first WYSIWYG tools, and I don't even know if that term's used anymore. What you see is what you get. And, you know, that was amazing, right? Oh, I put a circle there. It's going to be exactly where I want that circle when I put it up on stage. And I'm not saying there aren't design tools these days. I mean, Flash has graduated it now into Adobe Animate. And again, I haven't used that in a long time. They've got other, you know, Adobe XD, and every tool that Adobe makes now can output HTML reasonably well, but there's still this whole multi-vendor issue you have. I mean, you've got Chrome, you've got, you know, all these different browsers, and they're getting better and better at rendering experiences consistently. I mean, these days, I think it's not as much of a, you know, you don't have to have everything checked against 50 million different, you know, devices and stuff. But we were really lucky to have a tool like that. I mean, Jonathan Gay, who created Flash with Macromedia, I think he started a company. He was part of a company, was it called Future Splash, that then Macromedia acquired? And because I think the first plugin was called the Future Splash, and then that became, I guess that's how, maybe is that how they got Flash? I never even thought of that. The F from Future and Lash. And so Flash, you know, just it was an amazing tool. I mean, I think we talked about this before, in an earlier conversation we had, just how it really brought designers and technologists together, right? Really, you know, and creatives were able to do things with code, experiment with code that, you know, other people were sharing. I mean, it really, you know, again, there's so many things we take for granted now. You have GitHub, and also, you know, you could search for so much stuff and find, you know, all these people who have contributed amazing things to the community. And Flash, I don't want to say Flash started all of that. I think the goodwill, though, that you had at Flash conferences, I never saw at web conferences that I went to, even at the time. You know, like, you just have, you know, there were still clicks, but they weren't quite the same kind of clicks you would see when you went to other conferences. You know, designers and nerdy programmers really got along together well with Flash. I feel really lucky we had that sort of golden age of Flash to at least let us all know, like, this, it can be as good as this, right?
Yeah, totally. That's the thing. And, like, I think in a lot of cases, it was kind of like the first big no code editor. Like, you could build a lot of stuff just by clicking in the menus and then it would obviously help you write some of the code for that. But at least the early versions, it got a little bit more complicated with ActionScript 2 and 3, but it, like, that to me was like game changing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, they and Macromedia and Adobe After tried really hard to make components that you can drag and drop if you were building out more interactive experiences. And I honestly think Flash was best for these immersive creative experiences that could do really nice things. I don't think Flash was the best way to get, you know, to make a contact form, right? That you wanted, like, you know, and it did grow up into Flex, and I definitely went down that Flex road too. And a lot of my developer friends went down the Flex road too. And Flex was really to appeal to all the Java developers out there to make it easy to build richer apps. And when I went to that migration in my career from working on more websites for film companies, I took a job with, I think my title was even something like senior art director. I'm bypassing a lot of stuff too. Like, I worked for one of the first broadband search engines that ever was invented, called ramped.com. It was ramped with a T. I'll never forget the CEO always saying with the T. But the, and broadband was just emerging. And so we were way too early for what we were building, but it was all in Flash. We built this Flash search engine that, you know, showed the results really well, could integrate external media well before a lot of capabilities were there for the web browser. But anyway, I'm going on a tangent now. Ramped led me to start working more with these kind of deeper high-end experiences with Flash. And I took a job with a company at the time. It was called the Content Project. It then became Schematic. I was probably one of the first 20 people hired at the Content Project. It was in Santa Monica, California. And again, just really lucky to work with really great talent. I feel so lucky that every step of the way in my career, I don't know if it was karma, but I worked with people who went on to do great things. At Ramped, I worked with Sandro Cassaro, who ended up creating his own show for Disney XD called Kick Batowski. He's still a friend of mine. And I'll never forget, he was younger than me, and I remember teaching him Flash, and it was great. At Schematic and the Content Project, met some really great developers that continue to build really great experiences for their clients. And I really liked that. That was the first time that I was at a company long enough. I was there for over 3 years, which in web years was a long time, or internet years. But I even worked remotely for them when I moved to Portland, Oregon. But we just had a great team, and I was able to navigate that company really well. I was able to negotiate a 3-day work week for them because I was still writing books, and so I would be in the office 3 days a week, and I'd still have this time to explore side projects, go to conferences. I ended up becoming the VP of multimedia applications at the end of my career at Schematic, and that basically meant I was in charge of the Flash teams across their offices at the time, and I was able to wear different hats. Like, when I went to conferences, I was recruiting the best Flash devs that were out there for the company. I was able to be in meetings with all of the big clients that Schematic had with. We did ABC projects. We did NBC projects. It's funny. We had a New York team working on an NBC Universal live streaming player, and we had a LA team that was working on one of the first full episodes. I think ABC called it their full episode streaming player. They actually won a technical Emmy for that work, and my team was part of it. I think it was Danny Mavromatti out of Seattle's Disney ABC office who was head of it at the time on their end. But yeah, we were building great experiences, and it was so I got used to being in a role where I could advise, you know, be part of sales pitches and be the technical expert in the room, but also, you know, sort of change hats. And, you know, if I had to roll up my sleeves and be a solutions architect for Flash dev or work with other Flash devs on projects, I could do that.
Very cool. So what are you working on today? Because you're transitioning a little bit more into video too, right? Not that you haven't done that your whole career.
Oh, yeah. I mean, these days I find since, again, you sort of start doing what you want to be paid to do. I've always had a love of video compression and dealing with different formats. Again, those early days with PBS probably got me used to And so FFmpeg was a great tool. It still is. I mean, I shouldn't say it was. It's increased in its popularity tremendously over the last decade. And I would say the majority of my client projects these days are people coming to me with workflows that they may have built even a decade ago or 5 years ago. And, you know, codecs are always evolving. You know, HEVC just surpassed, I think, AV1. I was reading an article by Jan Ozer, but, you know, for a while it looked like AV1 was going to be the next gen codec from H.264. But I think the writing was on the wall pretty early. You know, I have a Sony 4K Bravia TV that I use for anything from color grading to just, you know, watching content and testing out over-the-top content. And that TV just had the HEVC built into it. Didn't have AV1 built into it. I mean, it was probably a second-gen 4K TV. I didn't buy any of the first-gen 4K TVs. And so HEVC becoming a codec that people are now starting to migrate to more and more. In fact, I just got news this week that we Playful Screen, a company that I'm a partner of in Vancouver, was just awarded a contract to live stream Nostrica. It's a Nostr based conference that's going to be happening down in Costa Rica, on the West Coast. And so I'm going to be flying to Costa Rica in mid-March to Direct the main stage there. It's sort of an unconference. It is an unconference, very informal in how they're putting together presentations, having the community be really part of the event planning. But we're again, COVID sort of informed a lot of new approaches or accelerated new approaches to remote video production, right? Because COVID instituted all these restrictions on how many people you could have in one place. And we're not under any of those restrictions, but we're using the same kind of approaches that we developed during COVID. So all of the cameras that our plan right now, if we have the bandwidth, and it looks like we will, we'll be streaming raw camera feeds from that conference using SRT, which is a newer protocol that's slowly replacing RTMP workflows. Again, Flash sort of started. So we're going to be using SRT, Secure Reliable Transport, to push 4K HEVC streams from location to a remote ingest on the cloud. And then we'll have our production team in Vancouver basically doing the live feed from the content we're sending them. And of course, we have redundancies in play too, so that, you know, if the internet's not working as expected, if we have to do live switching on site, we'll be able to do that as well. But it definitely reduces our footprint. You know, basically the cost savings we can give the clients that we were able to provide to clients during COVID, we can now continue to do, right? Like, hey, we don't need to send four people to Costa Rica. We'll send, like, I'm managing an entire stage by myself. Another partner is going to be managing another stage, and we're going to, you know, it greatly frees up my responsibility to just make sure, hey, I'm going to make sure we get the best shots, and I don't have to be responsible for wearing five different hats on site to do the live switching, run to a camera and try and move it. You know, a lot of the productions I've done for government over the day, over my career, I have had either limited resources to run those productions just because budgets weren't as big as they would need to be to support, you know, a full team running it. But sort of set the bar really high for ourselves to be able to run high quality production that had very good, typically post-production kind of value, but to do it during a live event. So that's exciting to me, because that's the first big event we've got booked this year. I'm hoping we're going to just start to see more and more of that. So again, and FFmpeg was a big part of my experimentation with SRT and being able to sort of tweak different parameters to see, you know, what we would need to do with SRT to keep the latency as low as possible, but keep the quality as high as we could, particularly with 4K. I would say a lot of productions are still 1080p. But we are starting to see now that YouTube and a lot of social media destinations are supporting 4K, it's becoming more of a reality. As long as you and of course, like gear, again, just getting cheaper and cheaper to get high quality 4K capture gear that you can, you know, send out. I mean, and that's of course because now we're talking about 8K, right? So all the 4K stuff is getting cheaper, and it's like, okay, well, I don't know if we're gonna be jumping to 8K anytime soon, but you and I are both really lucky to be living in a world where we get to continue to, not only learn more, but just continue to have fun with the technology. And as it becomes more affordable, you know, you don't have to be some high-end broadcaster to create high-value content, right? Or high-production value content.
No, 100% agree with you. It's interesting. I'm curious, though, because tech right now seems all doom and gloom. What advice do you give to people, or what are your thoughts on the climate right now? Because I think in some ways, a lot of people might not be getting into tech right now because they're just scared of what's happening.
Yeah, I think it is hard to just sort of generically jump into tech, right? If you're in school right now, again, I haven't been going to school for a long time now, and I haven't been teaching for a while now, so I'm not really current with how well curriculums are keeping up. But I think it's just like anything, you know, when I studied American history growing up, like it always ended at JFK. Like, you know, we never learned anything about the 70s or 80s because no one wanted to touch it. And so, but it was always just behind too, right? And so I think universities are always in a catch-up game, right? Because, you know, if they, you know, data scientists, you know, that's, and again, a field that's been emerging over the years. A lot of Flash friends of mine went on to become really smart and popular data scientists with data visualization. For me, it's like, look at the opportunities that are in the landscape still, and that might be quote unquote recession proof. And, you know, there's usually a way to find something that your passion is behind. I mean, it's so funny because I remember, so again, this is gonna be a little bit of a tangent, but again, like sort of just going back to the education part of thing, my partner Snow and I did 2 Wizard of Oz productions for my daughter's school during COVID. We had to do one for grade 6 and grade 7.
That's awesome.
And so, you know, because we have all this gear and we do these live events, we put together, like, we had a very short amount of time. We had like probably 3 weeks to shoot, edit, and produce a video for each of these classes. And the only reason I'm bringing it up is that at one point I asked the school, like, hey, can we meet with any class or teacher who would want us to show how we put this together, you know, and sort of go through everything we did to make it. And I'll never forget one of these kids coming up to you like, my dad told me never to do stuff, you know, like don't get a job that you love, like, you know, it'll just destroy what you love. Get a good job that pay. I'm like, this is a kid, you know, talking to me who's probably grade 8 or, you know, maybe he was in high school. And I just sort of politely told the kid, I'm like, well, I've always done what I've loved and have, you know, been able to succeed as well as I want to succeed. And I think I can thank my dad as a model and other people who were role models for me growing up to just sort of go with what you believe in. And I do feel like right now in my life, I'm at more of a crossroads about, well, what do I really want to focus on? Like we were just talking before we started this, like, what is my LinkedIn byline going to say? And so, but just to have those opportunities and explore them and not be afraid to try and, you know, explore careers that have your passion as part of it. I mean, it's just so important. I think, you know, when you see, again, I'm going to make a joke about my volunteer stuff, or rather not really a joke, but an anecdote. But, you know, I'll use karaoke as a example of how, you know, you don't have to be the best singer to get up there and have a good time with karaoke. You just have to be really into your song. Like if you get up there and you're stumbling and you're not liking it, well, the audience isn't going to like it. But you don't have to be a great singer to create entertainment for a crowd, right? And so it's on, and they talk about that on all the reality shows that involve singing. You know, it's just like, if you have passion behind what you're doing, you don't have to be as, you know, technically as good as someone who's really good but doesn't have the passion in it, right? And so I think that that's, again, it doesn't always work out that way. You might have to do some grunt work along the way that doesn't, you know, I'm not saying everything has to be something you love. I mean, there's a lot of grunt work. I mean, this week alone, I had a in prep for this Costa Rica event, I had a Windows 10 box fail because of a problem that I made on my own. I was swapping PCIe cards around and I mistakenly didn't see that the BIOS reset my striped SSD, mirrored stripe drives. And so Windows 10 just stopped working and I corrupted everything within 10 seconds before I could even catch it. And, you know, I had to debug for 3 days straight. I wanted to save it. Thankfully, I didn't lose any data. I ended up, basically reinstalling Windows 10 and building up everything from scratch. It wasn't my personal workstation, so you know, again, it wasn't a huge deal. But you know, I feel lucky that I have that kind of perseverance, right? Where I didn't just give up and be like, oh my gosh, like I'm just not going to do this. And so, I think tenacity and perseverance go a long way in tech. I joked with a lot of my students back at Portland State University. I said, you know, I sort of wish I stuck with pre-med because the human body doesn't change as much as technology, right? I mean, you know, techniques and drugs change that, you know, you might administer as a doctor, but it's a lot of work. I mean, even writing the flash books, right? I mean, I couldn't just write one book and it was done. Like every year we had to update that because there was a new release coming out. So you definitely, if you don't have the passion to really want to keep up with it, you're probably not going to last very long in the industry, right? That's again as we're in this downturn as it continues, and I mentioned this in a recent column I wrote for Streaming Media, you know, like it almost sounds contradictory, but have a core focus, right? For me, like I know a lot of video tech, but don't ignore the ecosystems around that core tech, right? Like you and I have already discussed, like I can have conversations with people in UI and UX. I can have conversations with people in sales and marketing and speak tech in a way that makes sense to other people that aren't tech, right? And so that, you know, having that kind of holistic approach to what you're doing is key. And that probably goes for just about any job, right? I mean, if you sort of have a understanding of how your network, you know, as you expand your network to different tiers, you know, you can even go in your LinkedIn profile and see, oh yeah, like I'm connected to this person because of this experience. And that could take me down another road. I mean, I think, I don't want to sound like Field of Dreams and build it and they will come, because a lot of times you can build something and if no one knows about it, they're not coming. Right?
So yeah, 100%. Like, yeah.
But you know, you still want to be focused on something that you want to do, right? And then, you know, there is legwork involved with making sure that people know that you are doing that and you've established yourself as someone who knows what they're doing in that area. And you know, there's all sorts of expressions, you know, in industries like fake it till you make it. I don't think you have to fake it, but you definitely have to give people, you have to have that confidence that people believe you know what you're doing, right? And that will go so far. If you don't feel like if people don't perceive you as knowing what you know well, then why would they trust you with the tasks they're going to give you?
No, I think that's actually really good advice. It's interesting. Any other thoughts around kind of what's happening in the video landscape? Because everything's streaming basically these days. Any advice or thoughts around people, you know, maybe integrating streaming or video into their startup or their platforms?
You know, it's funny. I just had a conversation. When you mentioned this, my mind went straight to friends of mine here on Salt Spring. This has nothing to do with video per se, but they should have a reality show. They have a company, Eagle Eye Marine, where they do tremendously dangerous things. They dive and bring boats up from the bottom of the ocean that have sunk. I've helped them with some of their comm gear over over the years, anytime there's electronic, you know, computers, come in here. Can you? It's like, okay, good thing I know how circuits work, because this really doesn't have anything to do with like software development. But he asked me, he's just like, hey, I want to start making videos and maybe live streaming what we're doing. And it's just like, I know he's not going to hire a crew, right? And so, you know, he started thinking like, well, should I make a YouTube channel? And here I start wearing another hat, like I'm a social media consultant. And I, again, there might be people who disagree with me on this, but I was just like, well, more and more people, and again, this is a no-brainer, but don't have the right starting point when they're thinking about creating content. Like, you know, everyone knows YouTube and that, oh, you can have a YouTube channel, but unless you're sitting at your computer for a long period of time, you don't necessarily have the privilege of going through and even keeping up with channels you've subscribed to, right? We all have busy lives, and we are definitely becoming more and more this TikTok, Instagram generation where, you know, we have precious time, precious little free time. So we want to be able to sort of feel that we know what's going on, but not dedicate a half hour to it. And I was encouraging my friends here that run this. I'm like, I think you should create an Instagram account and start making some reels. Cause he's like, I just want to make short, you know, tips about what you could do with boating to make things safer. And I'm like, well, just make sure you can distill that to the time, like to the limits that you have on the platform. Like I was trying to encourage him, like, not to get too wrapped up in big production, right? Because I know my friends, they don't have the time to sit down and start editing content that they're going to put on a YouTube channel, and they're not going to pay someone to do it either, right? And so they want to start somewhere, and if they can start building up a following with original content, it does, you know, we all know, I don't want to say it's a race to the bottom with production quality, but thankfully our phones are only getting better and better with audio and video capture. So you don't have to be an expert to get good looking content. You definitely don't need to know how to frame stuff and not have jerky, you know, cameras, movements going all over the place. But, you know, as we all know, you can go into Instagram or TikTok and edit your video right there on your phone, post it, and be done in less than 30 minutes, right? And probably less than 10 minutes if you really have it down pat. Like, I have a 15-year-old daughter, and she can make the most amazing reels in such a short amount of time, it's not even funny, right? No one taught her how to do it. It's just like, yeah, this is what I want. She knows what she's seen. And I think that's one of the difficulties, I don't want to say for, you know, people who weren't raised with the tech like our younger folks are today, but it's really just to decide, like, you know, what is your what is the goal here? Like, you know, like, is your goal to increase, you know, business? Is it really just to get back to the community and say like, hey, I want to, you know, build something that is going to be helpful to people? Like, Nick is a really great guy, the guy who he and his wife run the company, the Seagull Eye Marine, and he's a really generous guy, and he gets so upset, like, when, you know, bad things happen to good people, and he doesn't, you know, if you could stop it, you know, with if he can, you know, prevent, I don't want to again sound like cliche, like, if you could just stop one thing from happening, you know, like, it's good. And you don't know where that's going to go, right? You can build momentum, you can slowly gain an audience, and then you can make decisions. You can pivot, like, wow, this is good content that people like, and, you know, we can make it better. Maybe they would start to, you know, maybe it would lead to them getting a reality show if they really wanted it, right? And so again, I don't want to sound cliche, but the American dream is more present, I think, in social media than a lot of other places, right? You can become, and you might only have 15 seconds of fame, it's true, or 5 seconds, whatever it is these days, but, you know, if you create something that a lot of people like, then, you know, you can start making inroads into other things, right? I do think that brand influencers, that's a slippery slope when it comes to content creation, because there's a lot of people who create really good content that never really get to that next hump where they actually get sponsorship from a brand that they like. Or my closest brush with sponsorship, I run a fishing charter in the summer, and I did a really sweet reel with like, listen to me, Napoleon Dynamite. I did this sweet reel. I made a reel on Instagram that featured this line puller to pull up prawn traps, and I showcased the brand in it, and I posted it. I think it, you know, it got somewhere around 6,000 views. I don't know where it is now, but in it, which for that brand, it's just a small company here on Vancouver Island that makes it. He was so appreciative, like he gave me like a free motor for my puller, and really sweet guy. Like he was just like, I really appreciated that, you know, like I didn't even ask for it. And so I do think that, you know, what goes around comes around, and eventually again, and that's where, you know, the long play is hard for people just coming out of school or going into school. Like it's hard to have a long-term roadmap when you're young and or just starting out any new career, regardless of your age. And you know, the good news is it's not hard to find people to learn from, right? I mean, the world is a lot smaller with the internet, and there's a lot of helpful advice out there. There's a lot of, you know, content that you have to sift through to find the content that really resonates with you. But I think most of us aren't in short supply of media that our friends refer us to. Like, hey, I thought you'd like this video. Check it out. You know, I mean, that's part of the thrill of social media.
No, 100% agree. But sadly, Robert, we're out of time. So how about we close with mentioning where people can get more information about yourself, the streaming media, and any other links you want to mention?
Oh, sure. I mean, all of my current content is on streammedia.com. So you can just search for Robert Reinhardt there, or my column is called The Video Doctor. And so you can look for me there. I used to wear a doctor lab coat at conferences, like a lab coat. So that sort of, you know, ties back to the pre-med stuff. But the the streammedia.com is probably where I would recommend most people to if you want to, you know, stay current with the kind of advice that I put out there. A lot of my content is really more for stakeholders and product owners who are looking down the road of streaming media and what they're going to do with their content. But it's also for anyone who is looking to get into those areas of their career and the jobs that they're doing. My site too, videorx.com, it has all of my contact information if you want to look me up. And I always just say look me up on LinkedIn too. I tell all of my clients, anyone when I speak at conferences, I always offer a free 30-minute consultation to anyone. So if you are looking for, I've helped all sorts of people who have called me just with what you asked, like, hey, what's the best thing for me to focus on? And so in a very short amount of time, I try to, you know, offer advice to anyone who calls me up. And videorx.com/book is my booking link. So you can go there too to just look at my calendar, get a 15-minute consultation with me, whether or not, you know, you have a budget or not. I am very generous with my time to people who are looking for advice.
Very cool, man. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to be on the show, and I look forward to keeping in touch with you, and have a good rest of your day, man.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you. Okay, bye.
Thanks for listening. Please visit our website at buildingthefutureshow.com to join the free community, sign up for our newsletter, or to sponsor the show. The music is done by Electric Mantra. You can check him out at electricmantra.com, and keep building the future.